Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going a lot of places this morning, including to the top of Mount Pisgah, repeatedly. I'll explain shortly. At 9:30, we'll hear about the history of St. Albans and the help a local museum there needs. National correspondent Bob Day checks in at 10, then Jordan Berry of 7 Days tells us about the delicious literary piece she's written this week. And we finish the show by chatting with Governor Phil Scott. But let's get to our first guest, who's been stretching out, getting ready for this interview, and even more so for his big run on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Joining me now is ultra runner Jesse Holden. Jesse, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Really exciting.
Good. Now, listeners, if you want to ask Jesse about his run or how to contribute, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jesse, give us a little background on your running resume.
Sure, yeah. I didn't really start running. I actually hated running in high school. I did track for about a year, and the running was just too much. And then I picked it up when I was like, I would say like 27 or 28, I started running again, just because at that point, like, team sports had limited options for someone that age. So I needed to stay in shape somehow. So I was like, all right, I'll start running. But then I really found running like in the mountains and trail running, and that was kind of the big shift for me, because the road running thing doesn't really do it for me. I mean, I do it all the time just for maintenance, but my real passion is like being in the woods and just kind of moving my body over various, you know, objects and landscapes, I guess.
What is it that you enjoy about pushing your body to such extremes?
I think for me, it's probably the reflection and the time. The time to be able to reflect, mm-hmm. like having hours just inside my own head to think about, you know, whatever's going on or meaningful things. And then I guess the human body has always fascinated me, but the way that I guess the lows that you can have and then come out of them and then go back into them and come out of them again, all in the same period of however many hours, I think is super fascinating to me and one of the main reasons why I kind of continue to push the envelope.
Yeah. And when you're not running, Jesse, what do you do for a living?
Sure. Yeah. I am a PE teacher, so I have various positions, but I guess I'm a PE teacher at St. Johnsbury Academy, which is a public/private school in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. It's a boarding school, high school. It's got about 1,000 students somewhere. I mean, it varies, but 250 to almost 300 dorm students from all around the world that live there. And so I'm also a dorm parent. So I help in the dorms. I've coached various sports. I'm currently coaching gymnastics. And I'm the director of their outing club. So all things outdoors. I bring kids rock climbing, ice climbing. I brought a group running to Oregon before the pandemic in 2019.
Wow.
So, yeah, I wear quite a few hats there, but it's a pretty immersive school with lots of opportunities, so it's pretty neat.
Yeah, I'd love to see the kid who, you know, says, "Oh man, I could outrun the teacher." Yeah, probably not.
Yeah,
all right.
A lot of us stand in the sprint, but.
Okay, so last year you decided to create kind of your own fundraiser. What was the event you participated in, created?
Yeah, so last year I called the event Vertness, which vertical gain and like Christmas. It was right around Christmas. Might have been a couple days before last year. I can't really remember. But it was basically I got the idea from a running company out in Arizona was doing like a Vert Miss challenge. So I didn't come up with that name. That was coined, I think, by them. And the company is called Run Steep, Get High, and they're out of Arizona. And they created an event that was like kind of a Vert Miss thing, but I think it was over a month to see like how much vertical gain you could get. So it was a combination of kind of that idea. And then I'm an ambassador for Athletic Brewing, which is a non-alcoholic beer company based in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And they were doing an end of the year, like kick 2020 in the butt challenge. And their challenge was like, I forget how many hours, but maybe 3 hours or 4 hours to get outside for like 3 hours straight and do some sort of activity off road. So like on trail, on the water, et cetera. And then we were all going to talk about it and like post the stats and yada yada and like, and talk about it in their end of the year wrap up. So it was a kind of a combination of those two things that gave me the idea to do Pisgah, and Pisgah is like my sacred place anyway. So mm-hmm. Pisgah was the first place I thought of. And I wanted to do something that was, I had planned on doing like some longer events, but they all got canceled because of COVID. So it was kind of like my end of the year thing too, where like, all right, I want to do something really hard. So I decided that I was going to hike/run/walk Pisgah for 12 hours. And then like in the midst of kind of planning that, I was like, why don't I do this for others too, or have it be bigger than just like this thing that I'm doing for myself, you know, because that oftentimes this like, the running can feel selfish to me because it takes so much time. So that's how I came up with the fundraiser idea where, you know, I thought maybe if I can get a little press on this and put it out there, people would be inclined to donate to this awesome nonprofit that I set it up for. And that's kind of how the Vert Miss last year kind of came to fruition.
You do realize that 12 is much greater than three. So how much ground did you cover in the 12 hours last year?
Yeah, I think in the 12 hours last year, it was about 33 or 34 miles, and like 13,300 or 400 feet of elevation gain and loss.
Mm.
So quite a bit of gain, mileage, not crazy, but Pisgah is super steep, right?
Yeah.
I started on the south end and went from the south end to the north end, and you start climbing immediately and like you gain like something like, I don't know, 1200 feet, you know, in the first 2 miles. Wow. And then, so it's a steep mountain.
How much did you wind up raising last year?
I think last year I raised like almost $7,000.
Wow.
My goal was 1,000. It was funny because in the beginning I was like, oh, 1,000. I don't think I can raise 1,000. You know, you have all these self-doubts like mm-hmm. in the beginning. Tell yourself you can't do things that you really can. But anyways, at the end I ended up raising like almost 7,000, I think. Which is definitely something. I mean, it helps out their programming for sure. They're a small nonprofit.
Well, let's talk about who they are. We haven't mentioned them.
Yeah.
Talk about the organization and the work they do.
Sure. So Umbrella is a very small nonprofit based in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and Newport, Vermont. And they do advocacy work for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, among other things. They work with like dating violence, human trafficking. They have a pretty wide berth of like things that they do, but mostly it's providing legal legal advice for survivors. They will work with them on temporary housing. They work with them on job, like education, so how to get a job afterwards, because oftentimes these women are really, that's like one of the parts of the abuse, right, is to really isolate. So they're isolated, like they haven't worked, they haven't done anything with, they don't know how to balance a checkbook, they don't know how to do finances, anything like that. So Umbrella will work with them on all of those things. They have a really cool program in Newport called Cornucopia, where it's on-the-job training. So it's a culinary program where they teach women to, like, all these cooking skills and business skills, as well as make meals for the Meals on Wheels program up in that area. I think I talked to a woman on Umbrella, and I'm pretty sure they do something like 800 meals a week or something crazy. Wow. That they put out to the community. And then they also have a gelato, business, which is really cool, where they make and sell gelato, and all the profits go to Umbrella. So that's kind of some of the – oh, they also do a lot of education work in the schools, and that's actually how I got to – well, my wife worked for them, but other than that, I got to know them – you're working with them as a health teacher at St. Johnsbury Academy. They would come in and do work on just relationships and healthy relationships. And so I kind of connected with them through that. And that was like, that must have been like 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, we're going to dive into that in just a moment after the break, because this is a real key point and reason why you run and this 24-hour run you've got coming up. Now, Jesse, last year, 12 hours, was, not enough apparently, because this year, what are you doing?
So this year, same idea. Going back to Pisgah, because I know it so well. But I decided to add 12 hours. So I'll be going for 24 hours starting New Year's Eve day some point, maybe like 2 or 3 o'clock probably in the afternoon while it's still light, and then ending obviously the same time New Year's Day.
That's fantastic. Can people join along? Do you have people? I know that I've seen a video with you and the dogs. if people want to run along, what should they know about, when to show up, sure, where to park, things like that?
Yeah. So, yeah, people definitely can show up. That would be fantastic. I've actually had a lot of people reach out and say, hey, can I? And these are total strangers.
Wow.
They reached out and said, I would love to come and support you, or like come and do a lap or whatnot. So yeah, that would be awesome. I think the biggest thing to know is that, well, I'll be starting, I think probably, like I said, New Year's Eve day, probably around 3 o'clock, 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's plenty of opportunity to come out and say hello, because I'll be there for 24 hours. So,
yes,
and then the only other thing is that the Vermont Parks and Rec has been gracious enough to allow me to do this. So the biggest thing to know, I guess, is just with parking, please abide by parking rules and regulations up there, which is just only the spots that are available. Please do not park on the road. It's obviously dangerous in many ways, but also they can't, if there's snow, which there might be, they won't be able to clear the roads if there's cars on the road. So no parking on the roads. And just in the given lots, which there's two at the south end of Lake Willoughby, the south entrance to Mount Pisgah. There's one at the north. There's a small lot on the north, at the north trailhead, and then there's actually an overflow lot, which is just above Lake Willoughby on the if you're going north on the left hand side of the road, which I don't know if it will be plowed, but that's up for parking as well. So yes, people can join, just abide by parking regulations, please.
Now, Jesse, you're calling it Rise Above Run this year. Mm. What is the message you want to make sure is delivered by your efforts this year?
Sure. So the idea, or the rise above, is to rise above toxic masculinity. But I want it to have more of a positive spin. And it's really, for me, like just encouraging healthy masculinity, or educating people as to what healthy masculinity is. And just this idea that that men can be vulnerable, and men need to work on their vulnerability, their emotional intelligence, their communication skills, all these things that were not necessarily aligned in for many of us in like what it means to be a man, especially I mean, we've gotten so much better now, obviously, with so many things. But like when I was a kid, it was a very strict set of like values or guidelines, if you will, as to what it meant to be a man. And it just didn't, it doesn't, we don't fit, like we don't fit in that box, you know, like I didn't fit in that box. I always knew that I was different, but I was forced to be this one way, and it's toxic. And that's where the, like these toxic, archaic, like attitudes and values, it needs to change because it leads to so many ills in our world. But definitely this domestic abuse, in this dominance that men feel that they have over women.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a call. Oh, it's Meg Smith from Vermont Women's Fund joining us. Meg, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Morning, Rick.
Morning.
Jesse, thank you so much for doing this work on behalf of Umbrella. The Vermont Women's Fund supports Umbrella and its work as well on a particular program that deals with teens. But I also wanted to address your point about toxic masculinity. There's a really great organization called acalltomen.org that deals with men and helping men break that, all those strict rules that you said you grew up with, and that men don't have to be confined to these roles that were once very traditional and in place, and now no longer, they just have proven to be toxic, as you said. So I just wanted to give you a shout out and thank you, and good luck with that run. That sounds intense. And wish you a happy holiday.
So, Meg, can we count on you to go out and maybe run a few laps up and down Pisgah?
In my mind, I will be. I'll be there in spirit.
All right. Back. Well done. We'll take it.
Thank you, Meg.
Thanks, Meg.
All right.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. And acalltomen.org is the organization that Meg pointed out. But, Jesse, why is this a cause that you're so passionate about?
So for me, I mean, as I said before, growing up, I knew that there was something different, and I didn't fit into this box. And I mean, I got bullied and harassed, not like terribly, because I, you know, learned to like fight back against it, but still, it was still tough at times. Cause again, I was not like, I didn't fit into that box. But for me, it's definitely more, I've been surrounded by powerful and incredible women my whole life. And they've done everything for me, really. And so this is something that I have to do, right? It's not, and I think all men have to do it. I wish that more would kind of step up to the plate, because it's like we sit in this place of privilege and don't act because we feel like it's easier not to, and it's being less vulnerable not to, right? Or like speaking out against it or calling out other men.
Right.
But yeah, for me, it's definitely, I mean, for my, you know, for my partner, I have a daughter. I have a 14-year-old daughter. Sorry, Gabriella. And
Dad, I'm 14.
I do it, you know, I'm doing this for them. I'm doing this for all of the women that raised me and were so gracious when I was like, did lead with this, you know, toxic values and was not the best, you know, a version of myself, and that have like helped to teach me, so many things and so many ways to change and to be better and to actually do the work. And that's the biggest message, that if I could get any message out there, like, you know, men, start thinking about this. I'm not calling any of them out, because I'm right there. Like, I'm right there with you. I am working on this all the time, right? Just the other day, you know, constantly my partner Kara calls me out, and she's like, listen, you know what you're doing? Like, you're mansplaining right now. I'm like, oh yeah. I'm like, I'm sorry. And like, so I'm right there with everyone. Like I'm doing the work. Like we just have to like start to do this work. So yeah. I really am doing it for, I'm doing it for the women. I'm also doing it for the men. Like I'm trying to help us all be better, especially the younger men that I work with. in the high school setting.
Yeah. Now, last year you set a goal of $1,000. You raised $7,000. This year, what is your goal this year?
So my goal this year, I upped the goal a lot this year because why
man.
Not? So I went from my goal was $1,000 last year to $10,000 this year just because I raised to $7,000 last year. So I'm like, why not? And I still have a long ways to go, but yep. I'm ever hopeful that maybe, you know, after hearing this, some folks would, if they could, donate or at least talk about it and get it out there. And I am going to leave. There's going to be more kind of a little more press on it as far as the Caledonia Rec record is going to do another piece or two on it, like after kind of a wrap up after I do it to see how it went. And so I'll probably leave the fundraiser open for a while. Like I'm not going to close it like I did right after the event last year. So hopefully I can get, you know, close. I know that anything counts or, you know, it all counts. It's all great. But I would love to reach that goal.
As of yesterday, you were around $3,200. How can people donate to this cause?
So if they, I think it's, like I said, it's going to be in some of the local papers, like, you know, Keep Your Eyes Open and the Caledonia Record. And then also if they go to they can email me at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, the number 3, and then Holden, H-O-L-D-E-N, at gmail.com. So you could email me there and I could get you the link. Also, if you go to my Instagram, which is Jesse Holden Mountains, and Mountains is just MTS. So Jesse Holden Mountains, if you go to that and either follow me or just go to my page, then the GoFundMe link is right there on that page. So that's a great way for them to donate.
And I think you can easily go to GoFundMe.com and search Rise Above Run, and you'll find it that way as well. That's how I found it. And
that's right.
Yeah. Jesse Holden is an ultra runner with a big goal to end the year and start the new year. He's going to be running and hiking up and down Mount Pisgah to raise money for Umbrella in St. Johnsbury and to support the cause. Again, go to GoFundMe and check out Rise Above Run. Jesse, best of luck in your quest. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah, Rick, thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for the CBS News update, and then we head from the northeast to the northwest corner of the state to hear about the St. Albans Museum. And coming up today at noon, listen to the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. And next, we're headed to somewhere in Vermont that I've never visited. Worse, I'm ashamed to say, I really didn't know about it until I saw a story last week that said this place needed some real and immediate help. Now I want to hear all about it and make sure all of you know the story, too. St. Albans has some cool history, and the fact that it's got its own museum makes it even more intriguing. So that's where we're headed this morning, under the guidance of a couple of the museum's board members. Joining us is Al Vugel. He's with us. Al, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much, Rick. I'm pleased to be with you.
Excellent. And we also have Don McFeeters. Don, great to have you here as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Don. Okay, and listeners, to ask our guests about the St. Albans Museum, or if you've been there for a visit, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Al, when and how did the St. Albans Museum get started?
Somewhere in the 1970s, Don can probably answer that better than I can.
All right.
In the 1970s, when the school district turned the new building over to the Museum Corporation. Previously, it was built just before the Civil War, and was a grammar school, then it transitioned into a high school before our BFA, or Bellsbury Academy, was built in opened in 1930. In between 1930 and the 1970s, I'm not sure how the building was built. Do you know, Don?
Well, Don, I'm really trying to see, where did the idea for a museum in St. Albans come from? How did that come into being?
There was a historical society created, and I believe it was 1966, and people started meeting in their homes in other locations. There was no museum at that point. It was just a group of people getting together to learn more about the history and beginning to talk. As Al said, the building was a school, and it was a 7th and 8th grade at that point in time. I think it was 1960, I'm not sure.
That's all right.
Now, it was 1978 when the school was the Greater St. Albans City School was formed. And then we needed to find the Historical Society decided it was time to form a museum. And so that was the beginning. It was transferred to a nonprofit corporation at that time, and it's been there ever since.
Yep. And is it still run by the Historical Society, Don?
It is not called a Historical Society. It's a St. Albans Museum Incorporated.
Mm.
That was established in about 10 years ago. That name, the change, and so it's still a nonprofit. We've always struggled with finances and making the museum sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
We've had donations from a variety of places, fundraisers, the community of St. Albans City and St. Albans Town have supported the museum. As well as many individuals that have been associated with the town and city. Because of COVID and other reasons, we have had a struggle to meet our finances.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's been part of the challenge and part of the opportunity for many years.
Yeah.
It's not a new thing, but it's really begin to hit right in front of us at this point because of the many things that are occurring in our economy and our society.
Yeah. Al, what is the mission of the St. Albans Museum?
The mission is to give the community and people of Franklin County a historic understanding of where we came from and ask the question of where are we going? So we have different rooms devoted to different aspects of the community. When you first walk into the museum, you'll see a railroad room which traces the history of the Smith family and the Central Vermont Railroad, in which St. Albans was the corporate headquarters, and the train passes through from the New England states up into Montreal. We also have across from that room the military room, which traces the service of people from the St. Albans area, from Vermont, participating in wars from the Civil War right up to Iraqi War. And then in the front of the museum, Don can really explain, that room is devoted to our agricultural history from the very beginning when the town was divided up into family lots up until the present time of how we produce milk and cheese and things like that with the dairy co-op.
Yeah, Don, please tell us more about that agricultural history of St. Albans.
The farming in Franklin County is a way to try to tell a story of farming and the agricultural community as a whole. I think the first item we have is a flyer that goes back to 1852 when the railroad was organizing to transport butter to Boston. And individual farmers were producing butter, and then they were collecting it and sending it south. agriculture has been a mainstay of the economy of Franklin County and of St. Albans for many years. And we've tried to describe some of that, both the dairy industry, maple. We've tried to bring in some of the farm life that exists. There had been over the years many agricultural businesses, Worthmore Feed, the St. Albans Grain Company, H.B. Hood with their cheese plant on Main Street, Agway, St. Albans Cooperative,
right.
The George H. Soule Maple Syrup Company, and we can go on with a number of others. So farming and the agricultural businesses associated with St. Albans have been an important part of the county and of the area, and in this room we're trying to tell that story.
Yep.
Because I view a museum as a method to tell the story from the beginning stages, you know, and helping us to understand what the future holds for us as well.
I love that there's a room dedicated to the railroad, St. Albans, known as the Rail City. And I believe at one point, too, the farmers got together to make sure that the line, you know, would extend to St. Albans so they could ship their products out from St. Albans. What is, Al, the biggest thing that's ever happened as far as a historical event in St. Albans?
Well, the biggest thing that we talk about is the Civil War.
Yep.
When some Confederate soldiers came down from Canada and raided our banks and shot one person who actually died from it on Bank Street. And interestingly, the school itself is right across from one of the banks that was robbed. And so those kids heard the noise and commotion and saw the Confederates running around the city, herding people into Taylor Park before they took off for Canada again and being chased by a posse of St. Albanites, the Albanites.
Oh, my. And I know those raiders tried to set a lot of the town on fire, but their like cocktails didn't quite ignite, and thank goodness St. Albans was saved. What a great slice of history that the museum building, that school building, was there when that was happening back in the 1860s. Al, the Smith family room has a lot of interesting history there at the museum. So tell us what's contained in it at the Smith family room.
Well, the Smith family room has a great deal of the memorabilia of the governor of Smith, Gregory Smith, and I believe his sons, and also some of the dresses that the women wore during that time, or his wife wore during that time, along with many of the proclamations that he issued for the state of Vermont. Additionally, the family donated a fountain to the village of St. Albans, which is in Taylor Park, and which Rotary just about two to five years ago rebuilt because of its age and recast many of the statues on it. And so that's part of what the Smith family donated to the town itself.
Yeah.
That wealth all was generated by the railroad industry.
Hey, Don, one room that has received an award from the Vermont Historical Society is the women's room. What's featured there?
Yeah, in that room, we've tried to tell the story of women and their involvement in activities. We've talked about some of the clothing, some of the rooms that you might find, or some of the things that you would found back in the early days that women were involved with. I think of a stove that's in the corner, you know, as a one of those items. Another one that interests me is a fans that people use to communicate with, and there's a whole litany of those that are there in that room. So it's a story of what women wore is from a clothing perspective, as well as some of things that they would find in their homes.
Mm. And Al, what kind of special exhibitions does the museum tend to host in non-COVID years?
I'm going to defer to Don. I'm a relatively new trustee.
All right.
Member.
Yeah, the one that I recall is the Hamilton exhibit. And then we organized as a part of that a presentation, and so it was several days standing exhibit, and then that one day of having a speaker come in and talk about the Hamilton, and so it was music and the story. The historical story of Hamilton didn't necessarily directly relate to St. Albans in Vermont, but Hamilton was a part of the evolution and development of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Al, you have a research room there at the museum. What kind of information can people access, and who's able to use it?
Anybody can use it. It's under the direction of a trustee who spends hours and hours there cataloging donations to the museum. And wherever anything happens currently that we think will be important, or the person who's making this project makes it available to the museum, we will keep it and catalog it so that future generations can come in and look up what we did. And a good example of that is the two fire departments. After 9/11, they created a memorial service for those victims in New York City and Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania. And a number of town officials and state officials spoke at that gathering of the emergency service personnel in the county. And those speeches were saved by each of the participants. And now 20 years later, there was another memorial service to those victims, and also to and remembering the people who first spoke. And so those speeches were brought out and read by some of the members of the fire department just this past year. So that's an example of where we document what's happening, and it's available for future use.
Outstanding. Hey, let's take a call from Rick Norcross. Hey, Rick, what's going on?
Hey, Rick. I just wanted to call in and say what a wonderful museum it is. And at one time they had a Sterling Weed room, and I hope they still do. And I want to tell a quick Sterling Weed story. He was a country's oldest operating orchestra leader, Sterling Weed and his Imperial Orchestra. And at one time I ran the Green Mountain Choo Choo for many years, and I used to hire Sterling to play with his orchestra every year. But one time he and I were both hired to play at Governor Dean's inaugural ball. And during a break, Sterling told me, at this time he's 96, 97 years old, and he pulled me aside and said that he had it made in the music business. He was playing clarinet at the Weldon Theater five nights a week, and then they invented the talking picture.
Oh, I love
it. Gospel truth.
Oh, I love it. Rick, thanks for sharing that story. And want to make sure I said yes. Don, you still have the Sterling Weed room there.
Yeah, we still have the Sterling Weed room. And this would be a great opportunity for people to come and get some insight of Sterling Weed. He certainly was a fixture in St. Albans and was an important part of the what occurred here in the city.
Yeah. Now, recently, Don, your executive director has asked St. Albans City for $25,000, plans to ask the town as well for the same amount, mentioned that the museum is in serious need of repair. How dire is the situation right now for the St. Albans Museum?
We just had to have some chimney repair, and that had to be done here this fall. We've got a roof that is in need of repair. We've got a considerable amount of brick that needs to be repointed and fixed. So some of those things are critically important as we move forward. The front entryway, there's a step there that has been kind of caving away on us, and we're having many times used the back entrance rather than the front entrance, and so that's another item that we're going to need to be doing. In the long term, we'd like to be able to get heat and air in the building so we could keep the museum open, you know, much longer than just 3 or 4 months in the summertime.
Yeah. Al, how can people support the museum right now in this time of need?
Well, there's several ideas. First of all, for those spouses and lovers who haven't yet gotten the present for their significant other, they can give them a membership. Membership's about $35, but if they really want to honor that person, they can give more money to the museum. So that would be one gift that we think is pertinent right now for the holiday season. We're also looking for more members, which, again, is $35 for an annual subscription. And for those people who are wealthy, the 1 to 3%ers, we would really appreciate if they could donate a huge sum of money, anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000, to repair the building or to create an endowment fund for the future preservation of not only the building but all its artifacts.
Yeah.
And for those people who are the 97%, any gift that they can afford to preserve the future of the museum, we would be very appreciative for that effort.
We're out of time, but I'm also going to mention that you can also, it's a great facility to rent if you're having an event or a wedding. I'm going to give people the website address. It's stamuseum.org, and you can learn more. Al Vogel and Don McFeeters are on the board of directors of the St. Albans Museum, and I want to thank you both. And again, stamuseum.org is where people can go to learn more about the St. Albans Museum. Thanks so much, Al and Don.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for a top of the hour CBS News update, and then we're going to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. And a reminder that coming up today at 1 o'clock, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by The Getaway with Monsieur Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Somehow the world just keeps making news, and because of that, we keep turning to national correspondent Bob Ney to make sense of it all. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick. I'll try to make sense of it.
You usually do.
That's a big task you're laying on me.
Yes, it is. It's your weekly homework, Bob. Mm-hmm. All right, start us off with the COVID numbers. We got a lot to talk about there.
Well, yes, with the COVID is now becoming a problem, obviously, because of the variant with Omicron, not the Delta variant. And what has basically happened is that the numbers are increasing rapidly. Actually, I tried to get some statistics to see exactly where they would be today, and frankly, they are going up so rapidly that it's difficult. But some of the stats have said that we've had a 22% increase in the hospitalization rates. I do want to stress that it depends on what area of the country that you're in, because we could have even higher rates, obviously in different parts. About the greatest percentage, over 77%, by the way, of the people are getting the Omicron variant are unvaccinated people. the vaccination rates since you and I talked last week are just really about the same, 61%.
Not making much of a dent in it. Now, this started in South Africa, so that's kind of the best place we can go to learn as much as we can about it. So what might we glean from what's happened in South Africa about the Omicron variant?
Well, yes, you know, and again, in our case in the United States, we're at around, 73% of the Omicron variant accounts for our recent case surges that were, doing decent at one point in time. And, of course, it was revealed at first was occurring and noticed in South Africa. South Africa felt that the symptoms were mild, but the actual variant itself was very contagious.
Mm-hmm.
So now, even though our hospital rates, are rising, over it, in South Africa, who's had a little bit longer history, not much. I mean, this thing came, as you know, fast and
very
hit
fast.
Us fast. But South Africa, just as fast as it came there and then started here, it's starting, according to South Africa, that the case drop may show that it's actually peaked in South Africa. Could we maybe assume that will happen here? It may.
Right.
So they're going to look at that pretty closely.
Trying to get ahead of this, President Biden sending federal help where he can. How effective will that be, Bob, or could that be?
Well, the president is announcing home test kits that
right.
will be delivered. Some of the scientific community say, well, it's not enough kits. Well, some kits probably are better than not having them. Will it be enough? Most likely not. In my personal experience with the COVID testing within my family of people that have had COVID, some had a negative test, retook a test because they were ill 3 days later, had a positive test. So, will one home test be enough? Probably not.
Yeah.
That may expand. Maybe the White House will expand it. But right now, the president is saying that, this happened overnight. He said that yesterday. And that, he wants to move on the testing. He's been criticized for moving too slow on the testing, but he wants to move for the testing. And he admitted yesterday that, this has just went faster, obviously, caught us off guard. So we'll see what happens with the testing and what the feds can do on that. And then when it comes to the economic side of helping, that's way up in the air for a debate, with the Build Back Better America program right now gone. And they're talking about what did the 2021 stimulus package do? Will they have another one, in the spring? That's all unknown. I think Omicron's going to be a big factor.
Yeah.
And that's another factor that's unnerving the economists, Rick, on how we're going to get out of this inflation cycle because, you could have restaurants, bars, et cetera, shut down again, businesses, and you know where that takes us.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned these two things. I was thinking the best thing President Biden might be able to do is repackage Build Back Better as the next stimulus package because that might be one way to get Joe Manchin on board. Let's talk about the friction between Joe Manchin and the rest of the Democratic caucus.
Well, this one is multifaceted in so many ways and is going to play out in so many ways. Let's start with, what happened according to Manchin and what happened according to Biden, if
yeah.
we can do the two versions.
Sure.
There's always two sides to every story. Well, according to the White House, and they were very angry, and they wrote, I think, a pretty intense statement on Manchin.
Mm-hmm.
They did everything except say lied in the release, went back on his statements, et cetera. They said that. And from Manchin's point of view, it's very interesting. And I had picked this up from friends in D.C., but he more or less also made a statement through some of his staff. Manchin is arguing that they were there on the price tag. He had been to the White House. They saw him, Manchin, having extensive conversations. He's a Democrat from West Virginia, on the floor of the Senate with other Democrat senators, extensive, long conversations. And it was about the bill. And then at some point in time, I think it would be on Thursday or Friday of the past week, the White House announced the bill was dead for the year. When they did that, there was a reaction within Manchin's office to feel that the White House was prematurely doing that. They were close, except for three issues that they were trying to solve. I think Manchin expected that the White House would say, we're going to continue this. Instead, they said, well, it's done. And then Manchin, I believe, would feel that, you know, he's being pressured and they're trying to just cut off the negotiations and restart them, you know, to re-pressure him as they have for the last 6 or 7 months. So he went on the news Sunday. He had his staff call the White House staff and say he was going to go on and tell them what he was going to say. And he went on and said he's done with the deal right now. Mm-hmm. And so that all fell apart. The reactions, and that's the other piece of this puzzle, Senator Schumer was controlled reaction. Right. Now, in your neck of the woods, there was a famous in politics, Senator Jeffords, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yes. And I know because I was in the system at that time in Congress. And Jeffords became very unhappy with a series of, quote, right-wing votes right. that he felt were not good. And he kept warning, you know, the Republicans. They had a 50-50 Senate. And the next thing you know, Jeffords became unhappy and said, I'm going independent, which right. threw the Senate out of the control of the Republicans.
Right.
That's recent history. I mean, that's within the last, what?
That was 2001, maybe, somewhere
right.
around there.
Okay, 20 years, so it's recent history. And Senator Schumer knows that. He was around, too, at that time in the House. So he doesn't want a repeat of that. So Senator Schumer is going to say, well, we're going to try. We're going to have a vote on this, up or down anyway. Everybody gets to vote. That way you can go home and say, I voted for the package. If it didn't pass, we'll try again.
Right.
But he's a bit contained. Now, the progressives are a different story. Ilhan Omar came out swinging, used the word BS in a different form, mm-hmm. and came out swinging. And then Bette Midler, of course, said that West Virginians were illiterate. And, you know, she's not a member of Congress, but she's a personality.
Yeah.
And then Congresswoman Jay Paul said that, you know, basically, I'm going to paraphrase this, it's kind of tragic that a small state has this much power. Well, welcome to the United States.
That's right. Well done, Bob.
Jeffords was from a small state.
That's right.
And he had a lot of power in the process of what would, you know, happen.
Yeah.
So you've got all those statements. Then they were talking about doing town halls in West Virginia. I would highly advise them not to do that, especially with some of the people they were going to bring in. And so you've got this whole inside baseball, you know, and outside baseball hits. I don't think Manchin cares about that whatsoever.
I agree. Just very quickly, we haven't mentioned her in a while, but kind of just a little bit milder version is Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema. And has she weighed in on this at all, or has she kind of fallen in line more with the rest of the Democratic caucus?
Well, she's kind of been quiet.
Yeah.
She holds her cards. She's famous for holding her cards very close to the vest.
Mm-hmm.
And she tends to, you know, she's not going to criticize Manchin. I mean, she was out there second in line, I'll call it.
Right.
You know, if they got through Manchin, they still had to get through her.
Indeed.
Obviously, getting Manchin would help, you know,
right.
would help them. So she hasn't been combative, but I think she's going to still play her final cards close to her vest and let it play out with Manchin, Schumer, and the White House,
yeah.
see what they're going to do with it.
Yep, I think you're spot on, Bob. National correspondent Bob Ney, always great to hear your thoughts as we check on the top stories from around the country, around the world. Bob, have a great Christmas. Wish
you
all the
too.
Days wonderful holidays.
Thank you. You too.
All right. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Sometimes I read some clever idea and I give it the old Homer Simpson, dope, wishing I had thought of it. This week's 7 Days piece by food writer Jordan Berry is one of those. Jordan, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
All right. Tell people the premise of your story this week in 7 Days.
Well, I actually have to give the initial credit to my colleague, Melissa Passanen. This was totally her idea, and I saw it on our list and jumped in and swooped it away from her.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it really is. Every year, 7 Days does a winter reading issue around this time, and inevitably on the food team, we end up talking to chefs or other local food folks about their favorite cookbooks or cookbooks they read for fun. And I decided to take the cookbooks out of the equation this year and talk about food in fiction instead. And so I reached out to a couple local chefs to talk about their favorite ways that food and drink show up in books that they love from throughout their lives.
All right. Well, give kudos to Melissa. Now, what well-read chefs did you enlist for the story that you wrote?
Well, the first one was, he was a pretty obvious choice. Richard Whitting is a chef and caterer who has done the Isolée Dinner Club since 2011 in the Burlington area. And in 2016, he offered an entire English literature theme series where he served food described in Beowulf, in Chaucer's work, and Jane Austen, Beatrix Potter, and Shakespeare. And then I happen to know that pastry chef from Honey Road, Amanda Wildermuth, is an avid reader and self-proclaimed sci-fi and fantasy nerd. So I reached out to her as well, and she shared a little bit of a different take on what some of the things, places you can find food in books.
Well, she actually draws inspiration from books of the audio variety as she bakes. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I called them her audiobooks, her secret ingredient for her incredible donuts that she made for most of last year at Honey Road's walk-up window. She was alone in the kitchen in the wee hours of the morning, 3 a.m. usually on weekends. And she said it was the perfect time to listen to audiobooks because it allowed her to multitask, and she was alone in the kitchen, so it was a kind of a dream job, she said.
All right. And so how about a literary dish that or meal that she found particularly engaging that she told you about?
Yeah, there was one that actually both Wildermuth and Whitting had in common, or an author they had in common, and that was J.R.R. Tolkien. Amanda's folks, when she was little, read her The Hobbit every year, and she's continued that into her adulthood and touches back on it annually. And so right in the first chapter, Bilbo Baggins finds himself sort of unexpectedly hosting a feast when the dwarves show up for tea. And she listed all the things that, you know, the dwarves pulled out of the character's pantry, much to his chagrin. It was seed cake and beer and coffee and red wine and raspberry jam and apple tarts. And she said it sort of kicks off this grand adventure of the book, and Bilbo ends up being this unassuming gourmand, and I loved that phrase. You don't really think of him that way, but there's a lot of food in that book.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, as you said, Whitting has held these literary meals in the past. So what kinds of things has he served there?
Well, Whitting hosted a Tolkien dinner as well, and what I loved about what he had to say was he kind of took the inspiration from that book and realized that when you write a menu, you don't necessarily need to write exactly what the people are going to eat. And so for the Tolkien dinner that he hosted in 2018, the menu included the seed cake and beer that Wildermuth mentioned, but he also included something he called the flesh of he dared not guess what, and something called gray maggoty bread, which he assured me didn't actually have maggots, which I think the fact that he hosted another dinner after that might have proved that point.
Oh, my. Yeah, sometimes you would rather know what's in your food than how it's being described. That's a strange twist there. Now, oddly, he credits G.I. Joe for his lifelong interest in food history. What? You got to tell us about that, Jordan.
That was a coincidence. Actually, he had posted a G.I. Joe comic on the Isolée Dinner Club and Firefly Catering Facebook page just a couple days before I called him to chat about this idea. And I was just sort of like, Richard, like, tell me about the comic. And he really credits it potentially launching his lifelong interest in food history, food culture, and he's now an academic back at UVM getting a food history master's degree. So in the comic, Serpentor has this kind of genetic memory of all of these famous historical leaders, and it ends up being like 8 or 10 pages of Serpentor recounting how pizza was invented during the Roman Battle of Alesia. And he remembered reading it as a kid and not really having much context, but being like, oh, that's where pizza comes from. It was a great way to learn that story for me as well. I guess I hadn't made the connection, but to see it laid out in a G.I. Joe comic was pretty cool.
I've got a pizza trivia question for you. In what U.S. state was the frozen pizza first sold in?
Oh, I don't know. I guess my guess would be Pennsylvania.
Oh, you're so close. Right next door, the Garden State, New Jersey.
All right.
You can use that one, yeah, next time. Right. That's yours now. All right. What are some other of Whiting's favorite literary meals?
Yeah, well, we kind of did rapid fire, and he listed off quite a few, and one was one of mine as well. And I think something that you and I have talked about before, the Turkish Delight in C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where there's a little bit of throwing your siblings under the bus for a sweet treat. And then in Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie, there's some sugar on snow, which Vermonters love that. And when we were talking about those, he said he's recently reread them to his young daughter. And one that came up when he was doing the English literature series was the Tales of Beatrix Potter, which was a whole theme dinner he did for that. And he really made me laugh when he said, in every one of Potter's talking animal filled stories, the central theme is food, but it's because someone's getting eaten or someone wants to eat somebody else. So his nod to that in these dinners was to incorporate some grasshoppers and kind of nod at what the animals and characters were eating in The Tale of Peter Rabbit.
Mm-hmm. Now, I believe in your past, you once made some very special cupcakes that had some kind of a literary connection.
I did, and special is what I think half of the class that I handed them out to would have said, and the others might not have had such nice words. when I was in high school, I had an AP English literature class where kind of the last month of school, you take in the big bad exam and the teacher's looking for a way to keep students engaged. And I had a wonderful one in Southern Vermont who had us throw a literary bake-off, and we had to, with pretty loose rules, just bake something that somehow represented one of the many books we've read throughout the year. And I convinced my bake-off teammate that we should reference Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which is sort of an absurdist play that references Hamlet. And the theme that we decided to pick up on was that things are not always as they seem. And with that in mind, we baked two batches of cupcakes. One was pretty classic, chocolate with vanilla frosting. And the other we did our very best to make look exactly like that were meatloaf with mashed potato frosting. And from far enough away, they were pretty identical. And so we handed them out at random in the class and didn't tell anyone there was meatloaf in half of them. So I'm hoping there weren't any vegetarians that decided I was an awful person.
Yeah, you didn't take that into account. I love that. A great story in this week's 7 Days. You can read Jordan Berry's story in 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Jordan, great to talk to you again. Thanks so much. Have a great Christmas.
Thank you too, Rick.
All right, take care. All right, we've got a few minutes, and I've been playing all sorts of favorite Christmas songs all week. I had no idea this song existed. A friend posted it yesterday, and I've got to share it. And it's J.D. McPherson is the artist, and the song is called Socks.
Christmas morning, sneaky as can be, I tip across the carpet and I peek under the tree. Got a gift from mom to me and bring it to my ear. I give it a little shimmy shake and what do I hear? Socks.
Two socks.
This is the worst gift I ever got. It doesn't beep or buzz or bop or rattle
lousy parasite. Tiptoe to the mantle, a scowl upon my brow. I reach up to my stocking, hang it from a holly bough. I reach right in and feel around for Santa Claus's loot, but all I find is something there to insulate my boots. Socks.
Yeah.
Oh Santa, how could you let me?
That is Socks by J.D. McPherson, and I am praying that Rick Cabot of Darn Tough Vermont is not listening to our show right now. As a matter of fact, I'm giving a lot of Darn Tough Socks to family members, as I do every year. They love them. Maybe J.D. is just getting the wrong types of socks as gifts. Get him some Darn Toughs. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to hear from Governor Phil Scott. And coming up today at 11 on WDEV, stay tuned for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
For a stress-free holiday shopping experience, head to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. Specialty coffee drinks, artisan soups and sandwiches to warm your soul and fill your belly. Grab-and-go meals, local beers, international wines. Upstairs, find a curated collection of unique finds from clothing and accessories to toys, games, and puzzles, candles, cards, snow globes, and so much more. Always free gift wrapping and excellent customer service. So enjoy your holiday shopping. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. This is my last live interview of the year, and there's no better way than to finish off the year than with Governor Phil Scott as my guest. Governor Scott, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning, Rick. I feel... honored, I guess, to be your last guest of the year.
Excellent. Now, listeners, if you've got a question or a comment for the governor, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Governor, our COVID case numbers had been high before the Omicron variant. How concerned are you and the Department of Health about what effect it could have on the state?
Yeah, obviously, we're always concerned. But from day one, we've always worked at focusing on the healthcare system itself to make sure the healthcare system didn't get overwhelmed. And so we look at the hospitalization metric in particular. And we've seen, you know, an elevation this fall, this late fall, and which is concerning, but again, it's just level. It's higher, but leveled out. In fact, you know, it's interesting because we reached the high about 3 weeks ago, and since then, the hospitalization rate has declined. Yeah. Where we're seeing other states across the region, in the Northeast in particular, their hospitalizations are rising. Ours are going receding. So it's good news. Case numbers were down a bit last week as well. That's good news. But, you know, we have to be realistic. And we don't, none of us know what's going on with Omicron. And it's like listening to a meteorologist, you know, somebody saying, we're going to get a storm. We think we're going to get a storm. It could be an inch of snow, or it could be 36 inches of snow. We just don't know at this point.
With all due respect to meteorologists, of course.
With all due respect. But we're prepared for whatever comes our way. And we are obviously in a position where we can watch other states and see what is happening with them, because New York and New Jersey, their cases are elevated. But again, the report back, and I'm in contact with Governor Baker in Massachusetts as well. What they're telling me is cases are elevated and rising, but hospitalizations are not. So again, we focus on the healthcare system and making sure that's preserved so that we can take care of people.
And what details can you provide about federal assistance that we'd be getting that President Biden is sending our way?
Well, the testing, mm-hmm. we test more than any other state in the country. It's just amazing what we do for such a small state when you take per capita. If you look at the list of the rate of testing, we're number one. And when you look at number three, or I think it's number three or number four, they only do half of what we do. So again, it's over and above everyone else. So we think this is part of the answer. Obviously, making sure you understand where the infection is. Many of the states that you're hearing about that are doing well have stopped testing. So they don't really know. They're just somewhat putting their heads in the sand. But we have, throughout the pandemic, have focused on testing in as much as possible. So the federal government, President Biden, has we've been in contact with the White House on a day-to-day basis, trying to encourage them to do whatever they can to help us in the testing regimen. And antigen testing, the rapid tests, are going to be part of the future. That's what we're going to have to rely on to determine whether we do certain things. And we can take it on ourselves. I took one myself last week just to try it. It's just quick, easy. You can do it yourself, and then you can make your plans on what you should or shouldn't be doing at that point in time. And if everyone's testing, regardless, and we'd rather have them vaccinated, but if they're testing, then you know on a day-to-day basis whether they're carrying any of the viral load or any of the infection.
Yeah. Let's take a call now from Jordan, who joins us from Waterbury. Hi, Jordan.
Good morning, Governor. I just more had a statement for you. I'm just honored to talk to the most popular governor in the United States, first of all. Congratulations.
That's just a snapshot in time, by the way. You're a hero one day, and the next day you're the villain. So I don't, it's an honor to be recognized, but at the same time, I don't put much stock in that. We're just trying to do what we think is right.
I knew you wouldn't gloat about that. Jordan, what else do you have for Governor Scott?
I'm going to push back on the governor a little bit here on that one. Governor, since the beginning of the pandemic, you were number three there for a while. So you've held up pretty well, my friend. You've done very well. Anyhow, that's what I was calling for.
All right.
Here in Vermont, we get a lot of the one side of the aisle, and you have kept such a steady ship here, and you have all sides on board with you, and you've just, during this time of chaos in politics, you've really kept Vermont steady, and thank you for the job you do.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jordan. His point is well taken, Governor. The bluest of blue states, and a Republican governor with such high favorability. So congratulations on that. You should gloat just a little, but I know you don't do a whole lot of that.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's just about providing leadership. I've always, throughout my political life, I've always campaigned and competed during an election. But after the election's over, you're a public servant. You're like the volunteer firefighter. You don't care, who caused the fire. You rush in to help out and do what you can at that point in time. And I think that most governors are like that.
Yeah. Let's go next to Newark, up to the kingdom, and talk to Allison. Hi, Allison.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I just wanted to make a couple of requests of the governor. First, I think, and I've mentioned this in a few letters to the editor that I've mentioned in the paper, and then, Rick, I mentioned this to you in an email recently, and I think that there is a real need in this state, as well as many parts of the country, to really look at compassion. And there's so much vitriol that's going on with people that disagree about whether to get vaccinated or not, or, I'm just really concerned. I have a young daughter, And I've seen some very uncivil reactions lately. And I'm also very concerned about, honestly, Governor, I feel like you've been pretty measured up until just recently. So that's just a concern that I have. And then the second thing that I would say is I feel like there's a whole part of this story that is not being discussed, and that is that I know of several people in our area that have had adverse reactions to the vaccines. And it has really caused a lot of people to just question and step back for a second. And I just feel like, and I've mentioned this before to others, that I feel like we're looking at long COVID, rightfully so, and studying that in the Vermont, you know, Health Department is looking at that. Why can we not proactively, from the Health Department and your administration, put out something to people saying, if you've had a concern, if you've had a negative reaction, we'd like to know about it so that we can all understand what's happening and be able to, you know, provide comfort and compassion to people. So that's really my request for the new year.
All right. Thanks, Allison. The point about compassion, I think, can't be hammered home enough. We all need to get through this together, and pointing fingers one way or the other doesn't do it. Her question, though, about the health department, you know, is the health department, Governor Scott, collecting information on those who've had adverse reactions to the vaccine?
Yeah, this might be a better question for Dr. Levine and Dr. Yeah. Kelso, but I've heard it asked at some of our press briefings, and they have assured us that they do keep track of that information. So we want to make sure that we aren't causing any undue harm. But again, for the number of people who have been vaccinated in the state, over 500,000 in such a small state, have received their at least one dose of the vaccination. Of adults, it's like 95%. So the vast majority have received it. And I haven't anecdotally, other than today, heard of any adverse reactions. So I'll be happy to check back through and see if they have that information, but we'll circle around and get that back to you.
Sounds good.
I just want to mention as well, I mean, you can take the case numbers for today, and it's 95% of the cases today. There were 643 cases today. 95% of them are amongst the unvaccinated. Mm. So, you know, all I can tell you is what the data shows us. And the data also shows us that the 20 to 50-year-olds, let's say, that makes up about 50% or more of the people who are not vaccinated. So, again, just looking at the data and looking at all the good that the vaccines have done for us as a society, it points to either protecting yourself with a mask and testing or get vaccinated.
Yeah. And we're going to go to Berlin. I think you know that town, Governor, and talk to Dave. Hi, Dave.
How are you today?
Good. What's up?
Well, I've got two things I actually wanted to bring a point on. Got a friend that actually got the vaccine, got his booster, and ever since he's gotten his shots, his health is deteriorating that much faster. He does not have COVID that he's been tested for. That's one thing. The other thing is they were talking about testing sewer systems to find the COVID variances. Mm-hmm. Now, when the sewer system is full of toxic diseases, how can they pinpoint one particular one out of it?
Mm-hmm. Dave, great questions. Governor Scott, let's start with the gentleman whose health has been deteriorating since he got the booster. You know, what monitoring has the health department done, or, you know, what follow-up would they do with someone in that instance?
Well, first of all, hopefully they have reported that to the health department and have seen their physician, and the physician would relay whatever information to the health department as well with the permission of the patient. But having your health deteriorate may not have anything to do with the vaccination, and I hope that's the case. But if it is, then we need to accumulate that data and make sure that we can find ways to protect people in the future.
And as far as the source system, I know Norwich University has tested for this. Others have. And, you know, Dave's concern, how can you tell? And again, you and I aren't scientists, but, you know, how can you tell that COVID is present or a specific variant is present? And I think they've been pretty successful at this, but I don't know that I could explain it.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a lab test, the same way they can detect any type of disease that might be in a water system or any type of outside source in your water system is able to be detected if you know what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So they've done it successfully at Burlington, the treatment plant there.
Yep.
And in fact, I think they just determined last week that they had seen the Omicron variant in the sewer system. So it is a good indicator. It doesn't help pinpoint exactly where it's coming from, but it is a good indicator of as to what's going on. But it's all a laboratory test, just like everything else.
Yep. All right. Next, we go to Rochester and talk to Pat. Morning, Pat.
Good morning. I want to take up a separate subject.
Okay.
The legislature is taking up short-term rentals. As often is the case, Burlington is also looking into short-term rentals and how it affects rentals for young families and this and that. And often what Burlington is doing does not always relate to the rest of the state. Down in Rochester, we are and have always been a large second home type of community. I am a realtor, so this has been a big plus in our sales, that short-term rentals as supplemental income for someone to purchase a house has been quite good for our community. I also own a property management business that does short-term rentals since 1988, mostly handling the rentals for those out-of-state people that come and buy houses in the Hawk communities that are located in central Vermont area. That also keeps those dwellings in really good condition.
Pat, can I ask you to get to your question because we're okay. Almost out of time, and I apologize.
And I handle long-term rentals for apartments. So how is the rest of the state going to be separated from the needs that Burlington has, and what is your take on that?
All right. Thanks, Pat. Governor Scott?
Well, there was a rental registration bill that passed the House and the Senate last year. In fact, I vetoed it. It is still pending at this point. I don't know if they're going to attempt to override my veto. My concern was that with the registration program, and it put all types of restrictions on you know, who had to enroll in this registration plan. My concern was for those who don't do this as a business that might have an apartment in the back of their home. This could lead to a lot of expense on their part. It might actually reduce the number of people in the program. And I also worried about, the camp owners and so forth that might rent their camp out for 2 or 3 weeks or a month during the summer just to pay their property taxes. And this would preclude them from doing that because, again, they have to raise it to a standard that I don't think is attainable. So I had some problems with the bill. I vetoed it, and we'll see where it goes from here. But they may override that, or we may take it up and see if we can resolve our differences.
All right. Let's try to get one more call in and talk to Chris in Waterbury. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'll try to keep it short. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Real quick question, something that you might be able to dwell on. It's probably not something that you could deal with, but maybe you know people down at the White House that could. Talking to my accountant the other day about Social Security, he made a statement that kind of got the wheels rolling there in my head. He said if they lifted the income level, in other words, how much you can earn before you have to start paying back your Social Security or the limit, you know, the cap. He said if they lifted that cap, it would put those people of our generation, you know, potentially back to work. And would that – so my question to you is it worth talking to somebody about it to see if it would do several things. Give those people a little bit better income level, help with the labor force issue, and help put more money back into the Social Security fund, which, from what I understand, the articles I've been reading, is dwindling and will be in serious trouble by 2035. So, you know, I wish I had longer to talk to you about it. But.
Well, and now Governor Scott has 45 seconds to solve the Social Security situation.
Well, first of all, yes, it's definitely worth talking with someone about this. It's probably not me. What we're trying to do in this state, we were successful in reducing the tax obligation on the Social Security tax. I didn't think you should tax a tax. You've already paid taxes on this Social Security, and you shouldn't be taxed on a state level anymore. So we were successful in getting halfway there. I'd like to see us get a little bit further. Secondly, there are a number of people, number of legislators who are running for higher office, want to go to Congress. This would be a great question for them. And this is some of Senator Manchin's issue right now with the Build Back Better plan. He's worried about how do we pay for all this. So, again, I think it's pertinent. I think it's a fair game, and you should talk with the candidates who are running for higher office to go to Congress.
Chris, thanks for your call. Governor Scott, once again, thanks for your time. Best wishes for the holidays for you and your family.
Yeah, you too. And hopefully you'll have everyone take some time to reflect on all the good things that are happening in this world, because there are some good things happening in this world.
Absolutely. Thank you, Governor. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. And listeners, you can feel free to suggest guests or topics and send them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at WDEV Radio, sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. Governor Jim Douglas takes the reins tomorrow, and Pat McDonald will be the host on Friday's show here on Vermont Viewpoint. And then next week, you'll enjoy five best-of editions of Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. I hope you all are surrounded by friends, family, love, and laughter throughout the holidays.